You are listening to the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast, episode 281, Android Wear and Mobile, both 2.0.
Season 7, episode 281 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is February the 12th, 2017, unless you're on the other side of the time zone, in which case it's just February the 11th. I'm sure. Matthew Dean Furlough, and nominated for Best New Artist of the Year is my brother, James Furlough.
Yes, thank you, thank you. It's an honor to be nominated. What is going on with my computer right now? So when I click my mouse, it's actually, I don't know, it's a good inch higher than where my mouse is actually at.
That is odd.
That's awesome.
Is that why the audio stuff has been wigging out? Because you're clicking on the wrong buttons?
Yeah, we should be good now, though. Did I get it?
Cool. Yeah, we're good.
It's like when you have a gun sight that's not like lined up properly, and you're like, oh, man, I got to readjust my thinking here. I feel like there's probably a better... Actually, I was learning recently that there's this phenomenon in airplanes where there's actually a delay, especially on bigger airplanes that are not like all hydraulic and, digital and all that stuff, where like you move your, I don't know what you call that thing, your steering wheel?
The stick.
Your stick, and there's a delay between when the plane responds to what you actually do, and so there'll be times when pilots will actually like they'll try to turn, and nothing will happen, so they'll turn more, and then the plane will react, and then they'll have overturned, and so then they'll turn the other way to try to counteract their overturn, but there's another delay, and it actually turns out we're like, it's kind of like a fishtail where the plane will slowly get more and more cattywampus and out of kilter and can actually like tear itself apart trying to keep up with what the pilot's doing. And sometimes like a system can break and that can cause a delay, you know, like for whatever reason. You know what I mean? Like some sort of digital system
go
down.
Why are we having this conversation, man? I have to take an international flight in next
week. No, you're fine. You're fine. Well, the solution to it is if you recognize what's going on, is to just let go of the stick. And then the plane will self-correct.
Right.
Because it
reminds me very much of, like you said, when somebody hits ice. The recommendation is always don't turn, because once your wheels finally get traction again, and which they will, if you correct, you're likely to overcorrect, and all of a sudden you'll be in an even worse spot because now you're overcorrecting and out of control.
Yeah, so exactly. Yeah. So that's what I felt like my mouse was like.
Yeah, gotcha. There's actually really interesting control theories that is like the essence of control theory, is how do you correct for things in the appropriate amount of time so that you don't start that wobbling effect, especially because if you know how a thermostat works, basically it's a switch that disconnects at above a particular temperature.
Yeah.
So as temperatures, if it's colder than the set point, then temperature's on 100%, and then once it gets above a certain temperature, it disconnects. Well, there's a lag there, and it goes above the temperature, and then it starts to fall, and it once again it lags, and it goes under it, and so
it
does a sinusoid around the set point. Well, in control theory, the idea is how do you shrink that that sinusoid as much as possible and eliminate it completely if possible. And that's when they talk about PID control loops and this idea of which the solution is you turn it off earlier and you fire it more intermittently to keep it at the particular set point.
Oh, that makes sense.
But there are situations where what you just talked about happens and You can introduce things to the system. If you tune the system to deal with a particular set of environmental constraints, but if you introduce other stuff, you can actually cause a growing sinusoid to basically explode the system, and that happens occasionally. And a great example of that is when we destroyed Iran's nuclear facilities. That's basically what they did, was they turned off the systems designed to stop them from spinning up too fast, and eventually tore themselves apart. Yeah, good stuff. I'm not sure what that has to do with the Grammys. But which is,
well, you know, there's sometimes they overcorrect for certain people, and I don't know.
So good stuff. I'm still in China, as I've alluded to, and you know, it's funny, we talked last week about how
Snapchat, where in China, that's kind of a big country,
Shanghai. Is the city of Shanghai, which is a city of 25 million people, so it's sort of a state in and of itself.
Yeah, seriously.
So where in Shanghai is almost as big a question as where in China, but I don't actually know. I'm within the inner circle, which is a region.
So that means you're not driving.
No, yeah, I can take the train pretty much everywhere. It's actually kind of amazing. So it takes about a half an hour for me to get to work, and it's a 10-minute train ride. It's 10 minutes from the station to the fab that we're working out. So there's a extra 10 minutes there.
Yeah, yeah.
And literally, the entrance to the subway system is 100 yards from my hotel door. It takes me 10 minutes to get through the subway station. It is
just because there's that many people trying to use it?
No, we're able to walk at full speed. It's just that big of a train station. It's the biggest train station in Shanghai, possibly the biggest train station in the world.
That's crazy.
Exits. It's 20 exits spread over like an 8-block area. I mean, it's just enormous, and you walk for 10 minutes to get through the train station.
Wow.
It should give you a sense of the scale of this city. I've described it as incomprehensibly large, because it is. It's just amazing. There's all sorts of cool little tech things. This is a city that loves LEDs like crazy. When we take the trains, actually, they have some of the best examples of it. Where I was going along, and the first time I saw this, I was like blown away by it. But basically, what they'll do is, inside of the tunnels, while the trains are going at full speed, they'll line one of the walls with LED screens, just a continuous LED screen. And then they'll start video ads as the train catches up to it. And those video ads will move along with the pace of the train. So you have these like video ads that just kind of hang in space in front of you as you're driving along, as the train's going along.
It's, I don't know if that was pretty the fantastic. Easiest solution to that, but wow.
I know, right? Well, I will say this. It's not the easiest, but it is sure, like, it's eye-catching. There are a lot of ads that I ignore. I don't ignore those ads because they're like, whoa, this is amazing.
crazy.
I know. But it requires an enormous number of LEDs, they clearly have a lot here, is all I'm saying. There's LEDs on everything. It's pretty funny. LEDs on buildings, LEDs on signs and screens. And I remember years ago we talked about like the future of where screens are going, and I've predicted that screens would become incredibly cheap, and we'd put some sort of a simple computer inside all of them, because those will become incredibly cheap, and you'll just have screens everywhere that are connected to the internet and just kind of universally useful. And China or Shanghai is definitely a city that seems to believe in the idea of screens everywhere.
Yeah, they're living that dream. Crazy.
Yeah. Well, and the coolest part about it is they're just not high resolution, so they are really affordable because they don't take a lot of, you know, unlike the OLED screen that will be coming to the iPhone 10 with its bazillion of pixels. They're not super expensive because there's, you can see them. You can, if you get close, you can kind of you can see the art, the red,
right,
green.
Right. Yeah, I read that rumor. We'll see the iPhone X potentially.
Yeah. Well, yeah. We'll see. I we're so far out. It's not worth talking about the rumors, but it's because it's always dumb. They're like, there's going to be three phones: the iPhone 7S, the iPhone 7S Plus, and the iPhone X. I'm like, I guarantee you that they won't have the S and the S Plus if they're going to have an X. They might, I mean, whatever. They might have the iPhone, iPhone Plus, and iPhone Pro. That I could believe that, but the naming convention stuff is clickbait. Anyways, I clicked on it. It worked. So
yeah,
but okay. Oh, I gotta keep talking. So now that we've kind of covered half of the tech stuff, let's actually get into it. This week, like every week, we'll be talking about technology and the continuing corporate opera. And by that we mean the soap opera of corporations, dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and the technology they're developing. But before we get into the heart of the show, James got a short disclosure he wants to throw our way.
Yes, I founded and worked for HPI. And we have a printer that uses ink and you can only print once, as opposed to one that was made by some researchers, which like can be, the paper can be reprinted on like 80 times. It's crazy.
What?
I know. But we only do it once. That's right. We give you the best quality.
So let me get this straight. Researchers have basically made a screen that only can refresh 80 times. You know, when you say it that way, see, my argument with the screen thing is that it's just not the best, or with the printing is that digital screens are going, like, they can be refreshed a trillion times.
Yeah, but it'd be nice to be able to fold it up and put it in your pocket and stuff like that. I don't know. I'm not 100% certain on what the use case is, but they print it with light, essentially. And you erase with heat. It's like the opposite of thermal paper.
So it's funny. So it's like a super fancy. It's actually the paper that's fancy, not the ink.
From what I understand, yeah.
Well, then that's never going to take off.
Ah. Super true. But HPI uses regular paper and water-based ink, so we're friendly to the environment. I don't represent them, though, or any of their opinions for this podcast. I also own part of Twitter, Etsy, and Lending Club.
Awesome. If you want to follow us throughout the week, I definitely suggest following me on Instagram. I've been posting my Shanghai pictures as I take them when I'm not at work. My Instagram is nextwiggin4, NEXTWIGGIN, then the number 4. Or you can go to Twitter, where I will occasionally tweet my thoughts at Matthew D. Furlow.
Can you explain the no leaning picture?
Oh, there are signs all over Shanghai that have that thing, no leaning. And I,
but like a little man that looks like he's leaning.
Yeah, it's literally that. And I didn't understand it until Friday, I guess it was.
Okay.
When I got onto a train and I was like the last person that could fit in. And so I'm like, you know, that classic Chinese subway photos, or sometimes you'll get them in Japan too, where they just, the subways are packed like sardines, and there's no place to maneuver. And it was just like, it would have been way easier for me to turn around and lean against the door. I could have gotten more space, but there was a big old sign right in my face that said no leaning. And I was like, I get it now. Leaning is a problem in China. And now that I'm paying attention to it, the no leaning signs are almost exclusively on sliding doors, like elevator doors and train doors and stuff.
So
people leaning on doors that are kind of open because there's no space.
yeah.
So
it's kind of a mind the gap type of sign.
You on it, actually, you know, it's really funny that you would say that because if you look at that picture, there it's the bottom half of a sign, and the top half says "Mind the Gap."
Huh. There you go. Yeah. Crazy. All right. My pictures are not nearly as exciting, but you can follow me at places like that. Just look for James Furlow everywhere.
Todos los. Oh, I can't. I gotta stop speaking Spanish.
I retweeted out this article that was talking about how your house should not be considered an asset, which I actually firmly believe. Your personal dwelling should not be considered an asset. And I thought it was really interesting where he was like, if the price of milk or gas goes up, it's a crisis. But if the price of housing goes up, it's considered a recovery.
So, right.
Does that make sense?
Not really. That's interesting.
Yeah. Apparently, there's a new research paper out by some economists that were talking about how if we could actually figure out a way to lower the price of houses, like if you think of your house like a television or a computer, how can you make them more efficient, better? I don't know, more higher power sounds dumb. More efficient.
Yeah.
And maybe get a bigger house. But for reduced cost, like that should honestly be what we're striving for, just like we are with our cars and our TVs and our computers and our drones. And
if you could, for example, and I think environmentalists will get a part of this. If you could somehow figure out how to reduce the highest of pricing across the market, an average of $10,000, all of a sudden it'd be very palatable to install solar panels on all new houses. Because they're cheaper, right? So we can afford.
Yeah,
more.
They've done the math. And they say it's usually it's about $200,000 is what it costs to build a house, and the average price of land. And they say San Francisco would be about $280,000, which is the high end of it.
Right.
But he's like, that should be your price range for houses, $200,000 to $300,000.
Which
he goes, they do admit for most places in the country. Yeah, that's actually kind of where it's at. So it's okay. But there are certain pockets where that's not the case. And you do get situations like in Silicon Valley where if you have it, it attracts high wage earners and kind of essentially locks out low wage earners. But the irony is because you have all these high wage. Yeah, but the irony is you have all these high wage earners who want those low wage services. It's hard to get. And he's like, and it hurts. Whereas if you could somehow, they were essentially like, this is just a fun thought experiment because it would require a change in thinking from a cultural standpoint.
Right.
Like we want cheaper TVs. Like that's what we want. We're willing to pay for cars, but we at least want more features for the cars, right? You want more bang for the buck.
Right.
It's like, and if we somehow as a culture adopted that mentality for housing, you'd see that too. But it's like, we just don't. We think of our house as an investment and admittedly for a lot of people, that is the largest investment. Though for the record, the math has proven just waiting for appreciation on your house, even despite what the article is saying, is actually probably one of the worst investments you can make. You are literally better off to rent someplace cheap and put all your money in the stock, put the remaining amount in the stock market. You will have more money at the end of 10 years than if you just bought a house. But
for my boss rents. And so every once in a while he's defended his position and he'll bring out different, examples of how it's like, unless you're going to live in the same house for more than 15 years, once you get through selling the house, if you include appreciation, how much money you lose on paying the real estate agent.
6% right at the top. That's a huge change.
Yeah, you lose. You would say it's a huge amount of money that you lose when you sell your house and you go and buy a new one. And it basically wipes out all of your on average, it wipes out all appreciation on the house that didn't get put into and effectively, like, what he walks through is, say, the idea being that you are going to spend as much money as buying a house, but instead of buying the house, you're going to rent the house and put that down payment, you know, mutual fund or whatever. And you just look at market averages. And it takes like 15 years before buying becomes more financially advantageous than renting. And that's,
well, and it's even, and then that, it's like, that's the break even point.
Exactly. You know? And so, yeah. So if you move twice during that period, so you only hold on to the house for 7 years, you're now like 30 years behind somebody who just rented for 7 years.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's pretty amazing when you actually look at it that it's just, like you said, it's just a bad investment. And
yeah,
now owning a house, I'm not trying to advocate against it. There are advantages to owning a house. And if you like owning a house, it is a worthwhile purchase, like buying a nice car. But just understand that it's like buying a nice car. It's not an investment.
Yeah, totally. And yeah, again, yeah, like you said, it's not an investment. I mean, there are advantages. You can choose to paint it. You can choose to do different projects on it. And that in itself has value. And that's what you're buying.
Right.
And that's cool. You're buying it. You're buying the security of, you don't have to move if you don't want to, which is nice, because there's no chance of, like, unless you miss payments, it's not going to get sold from underneath you.
And, but if your refrigerator breaks, you have to. You have to fix the refrigerator. There are disadvantages to it. I don't know.
Anyways, follow me on Twitter at James Furlow if you want to see that New York Times article. It's pretty fascinating. It obviously is not talking about rental real estate. And for the record, I don't buy any of my investment properties for appreciation. I do it strictly for the cash flow. So I'm okay if prices never move.
Right, exactly. Which is, you know.
But yeah.
It's how you're supposed to do it. So cool. Speaking of your house and upgrading your house, Tesla announced, they did a big story. They installed a battery backup down in Southern California on an industrial scale. They actually built enough of their battery backups at a power station to supply power to 15,000 homes for like 4 hours. The idea being that this is still conventional power that's being supplied to the grid, because that's, you know, where it's being supplied everywhere. So, it's essentially the same as what you would do in, it's the same cost strategy that you would have if you had a battery backup and solar panels at your house, where peak hour of battery production, or of power production for your solar panels is during the day, but it's when you need it the least. You need power the most at night because it gets cold and it gets dark. And so you turn on your house and people aren't at home during the workday when the sun's out. Well, you actually have a very similar problem with traditional power plants, where traditional power plants have to they're designed to operate at, you know, to handle a certain capacity. Well, that capacity is always calculated during the nighttime hours when the heaters are on because it's cold out and the lights are on because it's dark out and everybody's home because they're not at work. And power consumption for traditional power plants goes up a lot during the evening. So what they find, especially like the early evening period, and so what they find is that power plants sit idle most of, not idle, but they run at reduced capacity most of the day when the sun's out and everything. And
yeah, server farms deal with this issue.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, I knew a guy who worked for a he was an electrical engineer, and his company, they did these giant electrical engineering projects. And one of the companies that they worked for was this, that they were contracted with, was this, what are those called? Where you put old cars, like a junkyard. And at this junkyard, they had these
museum?
Like, kind of like that. A really disappointing museum. They
this is a pick and pool. That is awesome.
Exactly. They have these giant car crushers, effectively, that are like a bunch of teeth. You throw the car into it, and it just turns the car to mulch, effectively. And they're incredibly impressive because they just need an enormous amount of force to be able to tear a car apart. And these things, and what they do is they, once they get them going,
that's usually where mob bosses put people when they want them to disappear, right?
Exactly. It's just like that, but even bigger and more impressive. And so they, the thing is that they need a tremendous amount of momentum in order to operate and tear a car apart. And so these barrels, they just never stop spinning them. Exactly. They never stop spinning these things, and just keep them up to speed. And when you throw a car in, the car barely slows it down, and it only takes a little bit of energy to keep them moving, even with the car being torn apart. But this is the hard part. Turning them on requires an enormous amount of electricity, so much so that if they did it during evening hours, they'd cause rolling blackouts on the grid. So they actually have to coordinate the when they turn them on with the power companies, so that what they'll do is, like, at 4 a.m., they'll turn the power plants up to full speed and then turn them on, draw a giant amount of. I was like, they basically go to the lowest use hours, turn up and use up most of the power out of the power plant while they get them up to speed. I know. I'm just like, that's incredible. So the reason why Tesla did this is because they're like, you know, if we were to turn the power plants up more during the day, back up all of that power, and then we could, when it's cheapest to use the power plant, then the power plant can just continue being supplemented by the batteries during its highest peak hours, during the evening. And the power plants don't have to run as hard because they've got this backup. And in the immediate future, it doesn't really change a lot other than sort of how the power plants can balance their loads. But the big advantage here is that you now don't have to create bigger power plants to service an expanding population, because you're effectively leveraging the capacity of the power plant earlier in the day in order to supplementing that capacity later at night. So smaller power plants can service bigger numbers of people. And that does reduce emissions and costs and everything over time, which is pretty awesome. But it's just like, it's an enormous amount of batteries. It's to power that many houses. It's I have to look it up really quick. One of the downsides to being in China is the internet isn't super fast.
Yeah.
And it's in Google, my challenge is the Wi-Fi in my hotel is actually pretty fast, but Google and Facebook are blocked.
Perfect.
And since we use Google Docs for our
we're using Google right now for this video chat. Should we have switched to, like, Skype or something?
Sorry. Well, I'm just on LTE right now, and since I have Tesla, I get unlimited.
You don't have Tesla.
Yeah,
you
so
have...
it's 390. I know.
You have what? T-Mobile? Yeah, is that what you meant to say?
Yeah, T-Mobile. That's what I meant. They have 396 power packs that Tesla installed, and it's 80 megawatt hours of batteries. Might sound like a lot, but same amount of battery capacity that the company puts into its cars in just 3 or 4 days of production. So it's like 3 or 4 days worth of car batteries to do this. The power packs each are aligned with 16 pods of batteries inside. Each pod has 12 bricks of cells, and each brick has 85 battery cells. Add them all up, and it's 6,462,720 individual 2170 battery cells. So named because they're 21x70 millimeter cylinders. So a lot. That's what I'm getting at. It's just a ton. But I think to me the most exciting part is that although it is it's a ton of batteries. It's not actually like, you know, it's a, like I said, it's about 4 days worth of battery productions, and yeah, it's cool. It's interesting stuff. I like it, Tesla. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, that is cool. Speaking of Tesla, I have a friend. He's ordered the 300, the Model 3.
Yeah.
And he got a call just earlier this week from a Tesla representative saying, "Hey, we saw that you marked that you were interested in the battery pack for your house and the solar panels or the solar roof." And they were calling him saying, "So, like, are you actually interested in that?"
Yeah.
And he goes, "Well, I mean, yeah, when I pre-ordered my Model 3 3 months ago, yeah, I was. And the idea was sometime around when I get my Model 3, I'd upgrade my roof and get the battery pack. And it kind of like, it would all be together." And the lady was like, "Well, I realized it was 3 months ago, but we're calling you now. Are you interested?" So, yeah. He's like, "Yes, I am." And so they're continuing to move in that direction as well. And so we'll see what that means, in terms of when they're going to start rolling some of the stuff out, specifically the solar panels is what I'm interested in. And, with that, Ars Technica did a nice little write up on the state of residential solar power. And I have an idea for a new type of real estate investment based on this article. Yeah. So I'm like, "Oh, dude, this is awesome." So it's pretty crazy. They start out with kind of a, like, here's where we are and here's where we came from, that kind of thing. But essentially, they're, in order for us to... we'll say stabilize atmospheric CO2 concentration, and we're going to set aside what certain people think we do or don't believe. But assuming that's all true, it would come out to approximately 15 terawatts, I think. TW, is that a terawatt?
Yeah.
Sounds like a lot. Anyways, we have to create that much of it. It's a lot. And they think that solar is probably the one long-term solution that could actually pull this off. They're just wind and turbines and other stuff. It's not quite enough, but solar seems to be there. So, which is pretty crazy. And so, and they were also doing further math where apparently the sun strikes the Earth's surface at 175 watts per meter squared. So essentially they're like, so if we can just get 10%, does this sound familiar? Just 10% of that solar energy, like, boom, we'd be good to go. Which comes out to roughly 2% of the land in the US is all we would need, or the area of North Dakota, if that helps.
It's an unfair calculation because that average is average over the entire half of the globe, right?
Totally.
As we know, weather patterns. Okay, it's just I hear what they're saying, and I think it is valid to go down this. I agree with them. I just wish that they didn't ignore the super obvious stuff like the geometry of the Earth doing these calculations.
Yeah,
and calculate it correctly. Yeah.
Yeah, and either A, that's been accounted for and they just didn't get into the guts of the math like the XKCD guy would on a what if article.
Yeah, it's Ars Technica. They might. It's impossible to know. Sorry.
But anyways, their quick math says even if it is roughly the size of North Dakota, that's about 30 times more than available rooftop space. So we're talking large solar farms no matter what. But they're saying it's kind of a plus and minus bag. There are some federal changes that are happening where they're like, it may make less sense for like the government to get into it, but for individual organizations and businesses, like this could be the time. Yeah. And so one of the things that they talk about is that photovoltaic cells, PV cells.
Photovoltaic. It's voltaic.
Photovoltaic. There you go. They've been around for a while, actually. Did you know that the first one was invented in 1883?
Weirdly enough, I actually knew that.
By a guy named Charles Fritz. He wanted to go up against Edison's growing network of coal-burning power plants, but he only had a 1% efficiency, so it didn't happen. And then in 1954, Bell Labs demonstrated a PV panel by hooking it up to a Ferris wheel and a radio transmitter, and their device was 6% efficient, which was like, what? You know, that was obviously amazing at the time. And it was actually a panel, and it had connected to a battery. It was still crazy expensive. But the New York Times at the time was like, this could be it, folks. We're headed into solar. I'm like, wow, that sounds just like 3D printing. Yeah. So there you go. We just never learn. Let's see. During the 50s and 60s, silicon solar cells continued to go, and the efficiency doubled, but the cost was still pretty high. And to kind of give you an idea, 1 watt of a solar cell would set you back about $300, whereas power plants were being built at a cost of 50 cents per watt. So, roughly 600 times as expensive. And yeah, so not quite there yet. But then by the end of the decade, I guess that would be 1970s. Let's see here. They actually proved themselves to work really, really well with satellites. Right. So kind of a fun example was the Navy threw a satellite up into the sky and they really weren't sure which would work. So they had solar panels and a battery, and the battery like died in a matter of days.
Oh, geez.
But the solar array kept it alive for years. And so from then on, it's like, that's been the primary use case for solar panels, like putting them into satellites. Like, wow, it works great. And so that's been going on. Since then, let's see here. Solar cells continue to reduce in price. And in the 1970s, they actually were able to reduce the cost to $20 per watt. So still more than 50 cents per watt. But, you know, we're... Now we're not in spitting distance yet, but you know, it's getting better. Also, the efficiency was in the neighborhood of about 10% at that time, so just too expensive. So today we are experiencing an acceleration in interest, which like I think that's pretty clear, and that's due to a few things. Number one, there has been a significant decrease in the cost. There have been increases in efficiency. And there have been encouraging regulatory and tax benefits types of stuff. Plus, with widespread concern over climate change, like Musk, right? We're destroying the world. We got to do something about it. And then, and you get people like him with that concern that have some entrepreneurial innovation and money. It's like, that's a recipe for things to do well. So, let's see here. In many parts of the United States and in many other countries, energy from rooftop solar power is now, wait for it, cheaper than energy from the grid. And by the way, that does not factor in subsidies.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. So we finally, like, we have hit that tipping point. And I don't know about you and the people, like, where you live, but I have a bunch of friends where they're just like, all of a sudden, I'm like, wow, left and right, people are getting them. And it's because the math makes sense all of a sudden. So, like, yeah,
right,
I'm doing it.
Well, and one of the, there's actually a really exciting breakthrough. And I wish I'd linked the article now because I didn't. Maybe I'll find it before the end of the show. But Harvard had a big breakthrough yesterday or this week that they announced with flow batteries, which is a type of battery technology. And basically what a flow battery is it's you have a tank with a, it's kind of like a fuel cell a little bit, where you basically have charges built up onto one side of a permeable, what's it called? Thing. There's somebody at my door. I don't know who it is.
Do you want to pause it? We could do that.
Well, I can just bring
you at home. Turn off your lights. Use your voice.
I can say,
oh, wait, you got rid of that feature. Oh,
man. Yeah.
Man,
see, I think it was housekeeping. There's nobody out there anymore. Okay, good.
Oh yeah, that's right. I'm like, you're not at home. What am I talking about? You're at a hotel. Someone rang your door. You're in a hotel. Sorry, I don't know why I was like, just pretend you're not home. I don't understand what's the big deal. Yeah. But that is not your situation. I'm with you now.
Okay, huh. It's really funny.
You sure you don't want to answer it? I feel like if someone rings your doorbell at a hotel, sure it's different.
I'm pretty sure it was just housekeeping, which I don't want to answer because we're doing the show.
Were they gonna wait? What time is it there?
It's 10 o'clock. It's definitely housekeeping.
Okay. Okay. Well, I was just thinking like maybe it's turn down service because it's 6 at night, but that's not 6 at night.
Yeah.
I'm doing really well at putting myself in your shoes here.
That's all right. Yeah. Dude. So it's a bright sunny morning, man.
Yeah. Nice. Nice. Okay.
So the flow battery is this basically, and it uses super simple chemicals. To do this, to store energy, basically it uses like it can use like carbon dioxide to change the pH of the water and use that as a charge. Well, Harvard came up with some organic chemicals, I guess, that really improve the efficiency of these things to the effect of it can last like 10 years last like 10 years with the charge cycles. So there's a lot of excitement about this because they're terrible if you're talking about for like cars or cell phones. They wouldn't work at all, but they might work as an industrial backup for grids. So obviously the dilemma with solar power being that they only work during the day, when we've already discussed that's not peak hours. So it's possible that they can create, you know, trying to store energy into the night has always been the challenge of how do you get off of conventional power plants. And they might, it may be, James, that this week the discovery that allows that to happen was made. And
whoa,
which would be a pretty big deal.
That's a big deal.
I don't know. Or it's just, you know, Harvard getting attention and trying to compete with MIT because right down the street, and it's always a big
who's
the best engineering school?
Competition's good. Which is good. So, last point on the solar thing, and then we can move on, is that obviously I just talked a lot about residential solar power, but there's a new one out there and a new trend that's out there. And this is where I'm like, oh, I want to get into it. Essentially, you create a solar farm, which you're like, that's not new. But but it's like, it doesn't have to be huge. Like, you could take a normal like 1 or 2 acre farm and put solar panels on it. Like, yeah. And that actually, they were saying that they were in, what state was it? It was Maryland and Virginia. And they were like, they would notice a plot of land planted with rows of solar panels instead of cornfields or cow pastures.
Right. Because like, this is the sort of thing where as a private investor, you know, to build a power plant would be impossible because they can cost in the order of billions of dollars. That they're insanely expensive, especially when you talk about regulatory issues and stuff like that. And they're enormously expensive for upkeep because it takes an entire, you know, staff of maintenance work and so whatnot. But as an individual investor who doesn't have $1 billion lying around to build a power plant and doesn't want to get into that regulation, you can buy a plot of land and some solar panels and hire a dude to walk out with a squeegee and squeegee out the solar panels once a day. And
yeah,
you're off to the markets.
Totally. Well, I remember we were looking at one point in time, we're like, oh, we want to buy a place with a lot of land. Ultimately, we decided we like being in the city more closer to things. So, you know, I'm not like, this wasn't why we went for it. But one of the concerns was like, what are we going to garden all of this land? Like, what are we going to do? And I kept throwing out the idea of like, well, we could rent it out to a farmer and let them farm it. And they would just pay a fee or a percentage or something like that. And it'd be some sort of tax break. It'd be great. And
it's what everybody
I researched into it. Yeah. The numbers don't work out, so it's not worth it. Unless you're going to farm it yourself, then they're like, yeah, then it works out. Because if all you're doing is renting the land, it's not, like, from my standpoint, it's not farming income. It's just rental income, and that's just tax, just like anything else. So that advantage isn't there unless you're doing it yourself. So, but my thought was like, oh my gosh, dude, I totally could have done this. And there's been a few properties I've looked at where I'm like, I don't know, what do I do with this field? This is an answer. And I thought this was a cool little takeaway. They're like, these solar panels, like, this is just the latest way to exploit the abundant free energy of the sun, converting it to electrical power rather than to sugar through photosynthesis.
Right. Oh, you know, the nicest cool part about it is very cool. You know what the nicest part about solar is compared to your other, like, renewable power sources is it, like, the problem with wind turbines is that they affect the wind. Like, you slow the wind down, it changes how wind affects. Now, on a couple of wind farms, not that big of a deal. Like, it's not, obviously the effect isn't huge, but on an industrial scale enough to cover America, you actually would change how wind is affected in whatever regions you have enough wind farms set up on. Whereas with the power, it's just like, power just kind of goes away. I mean, it's not like it's being used for anything else. It's just, if it's heating up a rock, the rock won't be heated up anymore, but it's not like you're pulling energy out of the system that would otherwise be recovered. No, it is interesting when you think about it on that scale, and especially as things get more efficient and better technologies come out, more investments come into it, and it's heading in the right direction. One of the great examples I've always said is that, you know, we talk about, well, will we ever get there with solar cells? About how efficient they are. Is this ever going to be enough to be the end all be all solution for power production? And as you said, photosynthesis shows us that it's absolutely possible. It shows us both, A, that there is a way to do energy storage in such a way that it will continue to work when there isn't light on. And this is most important, the efficiency of photosynthesis is ridiculously high. It's like 80-90%. So we know that it is possible to build some sort of mechanic that is enormously efficient at collecting solar energy. Now, obviously, turning that into electrical energy can be a bit of a challenge, but the idea that we can do it, we'll get there. it's just going to take time. That is almost certainly the solution to the problem. It's just just time. It's fun. Enough talking about power production, James. Let's get to stuff that really matters in life, like your smartwatch.
Yeah.
We knew this was coming. The rumor mill has been churning like crazy. And Google announced this week their new Android Wear 2.0.
That's right.
Which is pretty exciting. And along with it, LG launched two new watches. And we want to bring that to you guys because it's the people we are. I read reviews of both of the watches. I didn't get to try them, unfortunately. But they have like a sport oriented watch, and then like they call it the style
slim, right? Style slim.
It's the style, and which is a dumb name. but it's, you know, they're going for that Apple, the Apple market of Apple has the sport, the watch, and the edition. And from what I've read, the style is okay. From a fashion perspective, it's pretty good. It's a thin band. It's a pretty decent looking watch. But they erred on the side of having it, like you said, be slim. And so it's not as powerful as it really should be. Whereas the Sport is kind of like their full featured watch and really takes advantage of the new Android Wear. So I want to go run through some of the big new advantages of Android Wear before we talk about the Sport, which is probably the watch I would go for if I were in that market. So number one, simple navigation. Building better navigation has been like a huge thing with all of your different smartwatch, whether it's the iPhone or the Apple Watch, the Android Wear, or that one company that does the running stuff. What are they called? Oh my gosh.
Fitbit.
Fitbit. There we go. You know, having easy navigation is huge. So Wear 2.0, that was a big focus of it. Trying to get it to the point where, yeah, it's just easier to navigate. Customizable watch faces. So the idea being here,
jealous.
You could have customizable watches before, but you kind of had to choose between like very simple functionality and style versus highly functional but no style. So it's the compilations, or no,
not the complications.
There we go. The complications, which is now just the word that everybody uses because Apple set the precedent. That's how you know Apple's winning, because their language is the one that everybody's using.
Isn't that the official language of them?
Well, that's why Apple went with it, but that's not what Android called them. Android was just going with them being
widgets,
but now they're complications because Apple decided to leverage the language of traditional watches. And which everybody kind of like in retrospect, I think what happened was Apple made that announcement and everybody kind of stepped back and thought, yeah, they were right on that, which is why everybody ran to absorb that language so quickly. So now the idea is with Wear 2.0, you can customize the inbuilt watch faces directly from the watch, and they're way more options than used to be. You can easily change color, complications, background, and much more. Probably take a minute for watch face designers to release faces that work with the new system. But when they do, we should be able to have round watch faces that actually look decent while giving us the information we want, all without requiring a degree in both computer engineering and graphic design. They're just getting better at customizable watch faces, which is something that you'll probably, as an Apple Watch fan or wearer, be jealous of for a long time. They're also working on third-party complications. That's something that I guess wasn't available in Android Wear 1.0. Apple's had it since Apple Watch OS 2.0. And being able to have third parties build these complications. This is just getting up to parity. It's a big thing. It's important, but they're just getting up to parity. Apps work without your phone. Once again, this is something that Apple's had for a generation of their OS, but that doesn't diminish the importance of now it works with Android watches. So this is all sort of moving towards faster watches working better, especially because a big part of this was last year you started to get your first LTE connected watches, and the idea was that the problem they were running into is that Android Wear just didn't really support the idea of a phoneless watch. Like, you still needed to download apps from your phone. You still needed a lot of the sophistication. You couldn't have an app that existed exclusively on the watch. That's what they're working on and getting better at doing that. Google Fit seems way better is the word. So obviously Apple from the get-go had decided that a smartwatch was a fitness tracker as a primary feature, and they've really focused on having those features be up to snuff. Google has learned the lesson from that, and Android Wear 2.0 gives a lot of functionality to that and a lot of usefulness to it. One of the disappointments, they had actually said that that originally Android Wear 2.0, they wanted auto detection on this feature. So like if you started going for a run, it would just decide, oh, you're going for a run. The problem that they were running into is that they were having a very difficult time determining between you were going for a 10-minute run and you were running to catch the bus, which from a health perspective is very different. It affects your overall. And they just couldn't, with just the watch, they couldn't get, they couldn't have it automatically detect when you did different exercises and stuff. But if you're, once you kind of commit to the idea that it doesn't need to auto detect, there's a lot you can do in the way of navigation, usefulness, tracking, and so they really made that a big focus, and just made it work better. This is the one that kind of gets me. I'm excited about this. More sensor options than ever. Watchmakers have just been, they have a boggling number of connectivity options when they make Android Wear 2.0 watch devices. Smartwatches will all have Bluetooth, of course, but they can also feature Wi-Fi, LTE, GPS, NFC, and heart rate sensors. Yes, I want all of those things. And maybe more. Google says the Android Wear will automatically select the best internet connectivity options available to it, depending on the circumstances. Sometimes it'll be Bluetooth from your phone. Sometimes it'll be straight up LTE directly from the watch. LG's Sport and Style smartwatches are basically at the two extreme ends of the spectrum. The Sport is a beast with everything possible in it, including LTE for streaming music during your run, so you don't have to fuss with remembering to load up your smartwatch with songs before you set it, Apple. It will also let you make calls and send texts, and on some carriers, it'll do this with the same phone number as your phone, which is pretty awesome. The Style, on the other hand, bare bones. It has Bluetooth and Wi-Fi, but nothing else. Keeps skinny, but also means you're not going to get to make any Android Pay transactions with it, which I'm kind of like.
Why would you get it? It's just a sports tracker, a step tracker, essentially, notifications.
Yeah. I mean,
if your phone's around,
I think that's the reason why I'm like, this is a dumb phone or a dumb watch. I mean, cause it's just,
how much are they charging for that one?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I'll have to look. And then
I think the Sport is like $350. Right. So it's gotta be like $250 maybe.
Probably. So then the last big thing is sending messages. They've really worked on this. So, other than voice text or with, you know, Google Assistant, which is pretty, you know, awesome, obviously, and your kind of your smart replies, emoji responses, the obvious ones, they've also included, a fingerprint, but where you can like doodle on it and it'll do. What is that called when you write with your finger and it does letter detection?
Swipe?
No, like you write out the letters with your finger. There's a word.
Oh, you write out the letters. I don't know. Scribble.
Yeah. Whatever. So you can write with your finger and it will automatically figure out the letter that you're writing down. And then I can't remember what that's called all of a sudden, but this is the cool part.
I use that pretty regularly. It works well.
Yeah, I use it on my Apple. I didn't realize that it wasn't that. I knew they had announced the feature, but I didn't realize that they hadn't actually launched it yet. Because on the Apple Watch, it works really well. That's my go-to. But I guess they also decided to put a full QWERTY keyboard onto it, which the reviews I've read, they're like, it works remarkably well, considering the fact that the touch zone is like tiny.
You gotta be really good at guessing what letter they're trying to tap.
Right, that's the trick, right? Is it's
that comes back to the interface, like at the very beginning of the conversation, you know?
Yeah,
where it's like, where's he actually hitting? What did he mean to hit? When? All that stuff.
Yeah. So they pretty cool. The watch is the Sport one sounds pretty good. It's got a little digital crown that has become, you know, once again, Apple kind of winning the war on that one. And it's got a couple of buttons and included in it.
I like it though. Google's like, this is a great idea. We're going to do this.
Yeah. Which I think is
take that snap.
Yeah, exactly. It's what everybody does.
So I did notice on some of their things, it's you swipe down for settings, swipe up for notifications. I'm like, that's interesting. The exact opposite.
Yeah.
I know, it's totally down, different.
Upside down, backwards Mac, as Mac Daily News likes to describe Windows. The Sport Watch comes with your LTE, which to me, I'm ready for that, James. I really am. I know Apple's doing their thing, and I'm not super optimistic we're going to get that this year, but like, I want it. I want it real bad. just being able to, the idea of the Sport is that it really is this thing that kind of can be completely apart from the phone. It's got all of the different accoutrements to be able to send text, get notifications, play music, do health tracking. For most of the things that you would do, most of the things you would do with a watch, you just don't need the phone anymore, which the big advantage here being you can now leave your phone behind and obviously can't do internet surfing unless you get a notification and you realize, oh, I got to go get my phone. I think that's the future. It's the future. I want to try it if nothing else. And I'm excited to see that Android Wear is really going to be supporting that as a primary feature. I think that the winning watches are going to be watches that have that as a feature and just put more pressure on Apple to get their act together and put an LTE antenna on it. It is kind of ugly how they do it because they have to put the SIM card in the watch, which takes up a huge amount of space, and Apple will never like allow that in their watch. So there's going to have to be some sort of a virtual SIM card for the Apple Watch, which might limit the carriers it can go on to.
At first, yeah.
Yeah, but I guarantee that's how they're going to solve that problem in the interim. And then, what was I going to say? The other big complaint about this is I guess the battery on this thing only lasts like 12 or 14 hours if you're like really using it, which is not enough. Like, you got to be able to go 26 hours under normal use, in my opinion. You got to be able to get me through the day. I don't mind charging it every night. I've gotten used to it. I've gotten a charger in my car. I got a charger that I take with me on travel. Like, I can manage that, but I can't manage I'd have to take it off in the middle of the day.
Give me 18 hours minimum, I would say.
Yeah, exactly. Right? I would say 18 hours.
Because I'm not, let's assume I'm just going to sleep 6 hours, right? That would be it.
Right. And that's
minimum, that though.
You say what that would mean for me is that regularly I would go out on, you know, once a week I'd go out and my battery would die on me because I'd be up for 22 hours. But like you said, that's a bare minimum. Like, that's just I can't believe you can't get all the way through a regular day. Especially because at that length, it's like I put the watch on and if I go for a run later in the evening, is my watch going to die in the middle of a run? And I don't know. I think it's
charging your watch is significantly more disruptive than your phone.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, which is,
you know, a phone is no big deal. You get to wherever you're in, you plug it in. It's convenient because it was already, you know, it's not attached to you, you know?
Yeah, especially if you have your watch, because you can leave your phone behind and get notifications still and be connected. It's the opposite though. With your watch, it's like, no, I'm,
it's like, I mean, this isn't even first world problems. This is like a step above that. But for me, I'm like, oh, I gotta take my watch off at night to charge it. Even then I'm like, oh, I don't want to do that, but I do. It's fine. It's not tracking my sleep, so I'm not missing anything necessarily, but even then I'm just like, I don't know. It's disruptive. So to not make it through an entire day, like, what do they tell you? Oh, just charge it during lunch. What?
I don't think they have a solution for it. I think they're just like, they just wanted to be the first one.
They wanted to get all the features and the battery was whatever it was going to be.
Exactly. Do your best.
Okay. So I don't know if I would recommend buying the watch just solely based on that. I might wait to see what others come out with. This is kind of their... They're not calling it their flagship watch. They're just saying this is, it's almost like this is the capabilities watch. I don't know how to describe it, but.
And I have heard of one of the review that I read of it. Their thought was, look, don't like this is a good watch, and importantly, it sets the new bar. Like, right. This isn't necessarily your next Android watch, but you won't get anything made before this anymore. Everything after this is going to be better because it's all going to be. It's going to be hardware designed around the new software feature set, and there's going to be a pre LG Sport and post LG Sport sort of time periods in the Android ecosystem, which isn't shocking.
And I could totally see too where whenever their IO is, they go, all right, we got the next version of Pixel, and here's the watch that goes with it.
Boom. Right. Yeah. I could see that. So, it's nice. It's cool. It's exciting.
That is cool and exciting. Awesome. Awesome. So, I want to talk a little bit about something that a person named Benedict Evans wrote. I don't know who he is, but that's what's at the very top of his email, so I'll go with it. And it's this concept he's starting up called Mobile 2.0.
Oh, yeah. Baby. It's like Internet 2.0. What do we call it? Internet 2.0?
Web 2.0.
There we go. Because I say Internet 2.0 sounds dumb. I know the name wasn't a lot better than that, but...
Yeah, it was in 2004. Tim O'Reilly launched the Web 2.0 conference, proposing a generational shift in how the web worked. And... what in the world?
I have no idea, man.
This is what we get for doing the podcast during wake hours. My daughter has some sort of object and is banging on the walls. That's fantastic. Anyways, what happened with Web 2.0 in 2004 was this idea of saying, what if we just forgot about dial-up? And forgot about supporting old and buggy web browsers. And we just assume that there are lots of people who are online and they have good quality internet. And they're used to the internet. And so that was kind of the thinking behind it. And so as a result, you got things like one of the super early examples was Flickr. That had a grand total of 1.5 million users and was considered ginormous. How about that for like... how the world's changed.
Right.
And a whole bunch of other stuff where, like, obviously Web 2.0, this is probably the honestly, like, many, many, many years later, but probably the best description I've heard of the Web 2.0 idea. Because there was, part of it was like, well, there were APIs everywhere. Remember that? Like, everyone had an API, right. And people were putting things together. And there was also a certain type of look, and it had to do with the community. What was it? User-generated content was part of it. And then this whole idea of Ajax took off, and it was like, this is all Web 2.0. It is what it is. But I honestly think the best one is, what if we just assume that everyone has fast internet? Like, then what would you do?
Right.
And I'm like, right. Oh, brilliant. So,
because that's a foundational idea to all the other Web 2.0 ideas.
Right, exactly. It's just essentially we can start to make things more complicated now, and we can and we're okay pulling from multiple different sources since it's fast enough. It's all good. So, again, Tim O'Reilly launched that Web 2.0 conference. It was in 2004, which was 10 years after Netscape launched.
Oh, man.
So, as you know, we are now at the 10-year mark of the iPhone launch, which some would say, and I would be one of those people who would agree, like, that launched mobile 1.0.
Right.
You know, or whatever we want to call it. And so... he's starting to say there and say he's writing going, do we see the beginnings of a mobile 2.0? Some of these very early trends that are now capable. And so like one of them would be like, what are some of those assumptions that that we now have? You know, and essentially it's this idea of like, one of the big ones is that there are a billion people with a high-end smartphone now.
Right.
Let's assume that. How would you start your business? How would you produce your stuff? And so like one example he gave, it's a very easy example. He goes, remember Facebook, that social network, when they first started, theirs was like a web page, right? It was like a web page wrapped in an app. And then they pivoted to say, well, we'll go native on mobile. And turns out that was a little bit better. And so that's one of the, you know, one of the changes where instead of relying on people tapping on things, there's more swiping and whatever, which I'm like, I think those are all surface level. That's getting back to more like what was the aesthetic of Web 2.0? And that's what he's getting at there. Like how you interact with it is now about swiping and tapping as opposed to like tabbing and mouse clicks and typing.
Right.
But he had a couple other interesting ideas, which was, and how did he describe it? He goes, we are thinking of the camera on our phones less like a camera on our phones and more of a thing that she's like, it's this computer with a camera. I don't know how it's like, it has eyes, it can see it. It's more than just a camera. I'm not describing it very well at all. But it's more than just like taking a picture or a video. It's about like having fun with it. The idea of AR is kind of taking off with this. And a lot of the apps that we use involve a camera in some way.
Right.
So that was one of his things is like, you're just going to see the camera continue to play. But actually one of the biggest things that I thought was interesting is that you're starting to see the internet as we know goes through a bundling unbundling type of pattern, right? We saw it when it first came out. AOL had everything bundled together, and that was like, as far as people were concerned, the internet was AOL,
right?
and you accessed everything, your mail, your contacts, you browsed the web through the AOL interface. And then it became disaggregated, and you went to all different parts of the web. And then, in some ways, like Facebook has re-aggregated social networking, and then especially with mobile phones, they've re-aggregated those individual apps, and they're all bundled together. And what he's saying is that we're starting to see some of the unbundling happen again. And so he gives three examples. The first one, which I think is a dumb one to start with, but whatever, are the Snapchat spectacles.
Okay.
The second one, and this one's a better one, is Amazon's Echo. And then the third one, ooh, I heard myself echo when I said that. Nice. And then the third one is Apple's AirPods. And so he's like, these are different specific features of the smartphone that are getting unbundled and specialized, and now you're able to do some interesting different things with them. And the spectacles and the AirPods, they work with a phone, and the Echo requires the phone to do some of the more of that back end type of settings and whatever. But which I thought was an interesting idea. So for him, he was like, maybe one of the things we'll see is this, like we haven't seen a web 3.0. He's like, that's not a thing. We've right. just seen this basic shift to a different platform. And so his question was, will we see a similar thing here where all of a sudden we're going to have all these smart devices around us that are doing specific things and not necessarily. And then, you know, later on down the line, we'll have a great bundling again where we'll have robots that can take pictures for us and answer questions.
You know, it's cook us food. It's funny. It's funny that, you know, this is obviously a thing for you. But this idea of Marco, no, what was it? Oh, we talked about him during the holiday season. But it's the idea that Mark Andreessen, the idea that DJ, like, you know, we talk about computer companies, usually people think of Lenovo and the Hewlett Packard, and maybe Google. But the reality of it is, in today's world, they're not the only computer companies out there. DJI is a computer company. Because they build these highly sophisticated computers that happen to fly around.
That's another great example. Yeah, totally.
Right. And it's this idea
that the Echo is a computer, right?
Exactly. Well, and for anybody who's been a fan of robotics, the general, you know, people have for many generations thought of robotics as these humanoid robots, two arms, two legs, eye sensors in a head location sort of a thing. The classic droids from or the C-3PO droids from Star Wars. And even R2-D2 is a little too humanoid for what a robot can be. There's no particular reason why it has to be in this form factor. It can be almost any form factor if you let yourself sort of release.
Like that one from Boston Dynamics that looked like a scary galloping dog that would roll around and kill you if you got in its way.
Well, yeah, that's a good example. But even to the extent of, it's like, my company builds these highly purpose-built robots, which you wouldn't look at this automated tool and call it a robot necessarily until you take a step back and think, well, it actually has a very sophisticated, you know, computer running the whole thing. It has a whole bunch of sensors. It has mechanical moving parts that are all controlled automatically. It's got, you know, high dynamic control of gas flow and temperature control. And literally, you can control one of our more expensive machines. You can control it remotely. Like, every feature of it doesn't require any human interaction to operate the machine. So how, in what sense isn't that a robot other than it doesn't have legs and it doesn't move around?
The new type of Turing test. I like it.
Well, yeah, I think what we're starting to see is, as system on a chips become incredibly affordable and they're getting put into everything and everything's becoming smarter, we're starting to see that idea of, well, just because it doesn't have a glass screen doesn't mean it's not a mobile computer. And right. And how, you know, and yeah, I totally feel that. And then eventually what you will find, I agree, is that we will find all these purpose-built solutions. We'll find that, like DJI, it's everything about the drone is built to solve one problem. Put a stable camera in the air. Every piece of what they do is that's what the goal is. It's easy to sum up as one goal, and so you design an entire robot.
You know that eventually DJI's robot or PC is going to be replaced by another robot that happens to fly around with you, has an all-day battery life. It takes voice commands. It takes pictures. Now, granted, it's probably not going to be as good as DJI, so it'll be as good as theirs today. You know, it'll only be 4K.
Right.
It'll be able to, it'll have a video screen on it, so you can video conference with somebody. You'll be able to send it on errands and tasks. It will be your own personal flying awesome robot.
That's the idea here, is that all of these things, we're going to build these feature built robots that are very expensive, and we'll have that classic picture that everybody, you know, this was replaced by this, and you got floppy disks and a computer and a video camera and a regular camera, and you've just got, like, it's like an entire desk full of stuff, and then it's replaced with one smartphone. Eventually we'll have that again, but for modern computing stuff, you'll have the Amazon Echo and your smartphone and your drone and your personal robot assist, you know, you just all your Roomba and all of those things, and they'll all be replaced.
I want an Echo built into a drone that follows me around. That's what I want. I'll buy that.
And the thing is that I think humanoid robots.
I'm not biting
will forever...
on any of my jokes this week. I just want to put it out there. It's either I'm not funny, which is highly possible because I've had an off day, or we're just on different time zones or something.
I think that's the deal, man. I'm all wigged out for the last week. I've been in China, man.
Like, man, he didn't bite at all on my "I want a personal drone that follows me around" comment. I feel like that's right up your alley.
Right? Actually, you say, well, okay. You know, I've long been bothered by the idea of, you know, the idea that a personal, that the robotic revolution will look like people. It'll have arms and legs, and it's just, there's,
I'm
no,
not saying that.
I know
it has,
which I like,
drone
but I'm
blades.
Like, but I'm building towards this idea of, if you think about it, how we'll actually, how the technology, where technology is, where it's going, it almost inevitably leads away from that. It's actually like, it's something you have to put weird design constraints on yourself in order to get to the place where we'll have one humanoid robot that will do a bunch of tasks. Whereas your description is actually like, it's almost more accurate, except for the idea that I do think physically separate things, but digitally connected, is a much more realistic idea. The idea
we haven't seen that with cell phones though, right? Because I remember we used to talk about this, where it was like, wouldn't it be sweet if you had some sort of digital key and then everything else was just a kiosk, and it was like, you plug in, I mean, this is the idea of a Chromebook, right? Like, you just put in your username and password and it's all of your stuff right there on the computer. Pick any computer, it'll work. And put in your credentials and it'll remember everything about you and do whatever that device is designed for. We just haven't seen that happen yet.
I would argue that to some degree we have, though. If you were somebody who has a smart home with an Apple TV and smart locks somewhere, and all of that thing, yeah, you walk Amazon in Echo, and your phone does, yeah, your phone and your Echo sort of act as this.
Is it bad that I'm thinking about getting, I think it's the Dot? Is that the small one for my bedroom?
It's not bad.
That'd be cool. I don't know what I would use it for. But
you'll figure it out.
I'd talk to it. That's what I figure. It's on the other side of the house. You know, I can't talk to my Echo when I'm in the bedroom. I just feel like that would be useful to be like, Alexa, what time is it? I don't know.
I guess what my point is that the future of mobile is more sophisticatedly connected things that are, I don't know. I don't buy the idea that you'll have, I don't buy the idea that these things will all be physically one thing, but we'll have this, but there will be this delimiter where there will become a moment where we're like, yeah, they're all really connected. I have an ecosystem of small custom built solutions that maybe are all built by the same company. Maybe they have, you know, one thing as, you know, there, you can imagine a house cleaning robot that kind of looks like a Roomba with maybe one digital arm or one, you know, physical arm that, you know, can do a whole lot of different tasks. But the idea of, like, you know, the classic,
I want a robot to clean my gutters. That's
a good point. But it's like it's funny because what's that TV show with the Jetsons, and what's the robot's name? Doesn't matter.
No, his wife is Judy. The dog. The son is Elroy. Is the daughter the wife's? I don't know.
But the point is,
I know who you're talking about.
A lot of times, she's demonstrated as like pushing around a vacuum, which I think is an accurate and apt idea that a sophisticated
Rosie
connection of mobile devices. Rosie, yeah. Thank you. I don't have Google, so I'm relying on, this is my, you are my Google, James.
I got you, man.
It's like the Matrix.
I'm your live robot.
But what you end up with is, I think, thank you. What you end up with is this world where each robot, each sophisticated sensor robot control apparatus, they all work together in parallel. And I think mobility, you'll see that bundling not necessarily happen physically, but you'll see it happen digitally, where they're clearly, and I don't think it will be this, it's when you finally get to the point where you can just assume that these sensors are available and that they're usable and that you can function with them and they're secure, you are going to change your mentality of how you think about mobile, because there are features you won't put in a particular mobile device. that because you know you don't need to. And this goes back to my whole idea with why watches are going to, once you get LTE in a watch, it changes something. Because I'm operating on the assumption that there is a internet device that you can surf on nearby. So why, you know, it may not be your phone, it may not be your computer, but it could be any number of things. All you need is the notification to know you need to go back to your computer for to do the heavier tasks. And that's all people really, really need. I'm making an assumption about what you have mobily available. And I'm reducing the number of features I need on any particular device as a result. Why would you need a flying phone when drones are everywhere and you can rent one and just connect to it with your, you know, why, if your phone can just, if every, you know, if every city has a drone rental
privacy,
you know,
concerns,
site,
man.
Privacy. Right. Well, but I mean, well, but the idea is if every city has, you know, or like, let's say every natural, yeah, every, you, if you can just assume that when you go to the Grand Canyon, there'll be a drone rental place that you can just, digitally connect to your phone. And then, and then you have your drone for all taking all your photos of the Grand Canyon. You don't need a flying phone with you. You don't need a flying camera. Right? You know, so I think when we talk about what are the fundamental assumptions you can make, when the fundamental assumption of mobile is, you don't need a solution for everything. Then
I think
because
one of the other ones is just like internet everywhere, you know? I mean, that's
exactly
another thing. And fast internet everywhere.
And I'm actually, the more I talk about this and the more I think about it, the more I'm excited by it, because I do think that's the fundamental assumption, is that you don't need a mobile device capable of everything. And the bundling that will happen eventually won't be a physical bundling. It'll actually be a digital bundling. It'll be the exact opposite. It'll be this idea of, no, you really only need one connected device ever, and you can control a whole bunch of different things that you can just assume are there. You can just assume your hotel room will have an NFC sensor, so you can just walk into your room. You don't even have to check in. You just bump your watch up against the door. It already knows that you're coming. You can set the temperature for your hotel room as you're on the way, because your hotel room already knows you're coming. And
dude, it already knows what temperature you like from last time you stayed there.
And you don't need a phone, because anywhere you go, there's a screen that you can, you know, you can bump your phone up to, your watch up to, and it'll steal all your information. Those are the sort of mobile solutions. When you can start to make those solutions, you can then build software platforms based around these ideas, these fundamental assumptions of what's available to everyone. And yeah, I think that will make a huge difference. And you'll see entire companies built on or advance on that assumption. And I think the smart home is a great example of that nascent idea, of the very beginnings of the assumption that all of your everything you want to be connected to is there and available, and your phone doesn't need to do everything. All it needs to do is connect you to the things that are available. So, yeah. Speaking of which, I'm going to jump into this because I want one so bad. But the sous vide, which we've talked about before.
The sous vide. I want one.
This is like this company.
I was literally thinking about this afternoon, because I cooked a brat and I don't think I got it fully cooked. And because I was feeling a little nauseous last night, and I totally skipped dinner, and I was like, that's the only thing that I could think of, and I was like, dude, I should have sous vide this thing. That would have
been
a problem.
It's awesome. It's totally would.
They're not cheap.
They're not cheap, but they're worth
fish.
It. So actually, so this is what's exciting, because the sous vide there was a Kickstarter by a company called Anova that was very successful. It's like when you go on Amazon and look up sous vides, their sous vide is like the top one. They've got Bluetooth connections and Wi-Fi connections, so you can
there's really only one other competitor out there.
It's true,
in my opinion.
But the big deal is that this company, they got their payday this week. They got bought for a quarter of $1 billion, And
holy cow!
I know, pretty big chunk of change. But the exciting part about this is that it's a giant. I can't remember the company's name now that bought them. Doesn't matter. But the prediction of where
Electrolux.
Yeah, is that what I saw? Yeah, they do like this sort of thing, kitchen gadgets. But the idea is that this company's buying them because, A, it's a successful party product that people like. But because it's a successful product that people like, we're going to have more of them, which is going to drop the price down. And we're going to start racing in the direction of it becoming a commodity. And everybody's going to have a sous vide in their kitchen, which is super exciting.
Because there's the $100. The one, it's the Chef Steps one, is like $200. Which I hear it's a little better, but I don't know if it's twice as better. Man, I want one. 800 watts. Apparently, there's different style options. What do we got? We've got you can get one with Bluetooth or one with Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. That one's $200. Oh gosh. Yeah. See, that's my problem, man. I mean, I'm not afraid to spend money on smart stuff. I'm a little afraid to spend money on that smart stuff.
Yeah. I don't know. I want one. I'm excited. I keep feeling like I should build my own.
And unfortunately, I don't sell it very well to my wife. I'm like, you know, it's kind of like a fish tank thermostat or a heater.
Yeah, what are you doing, man? Pick her favorite food and tell her that there's no way she can cook it as well as a sous vide can. It'll be more delicious. That's how you cook it. That's how you sell it.
I feel like I should know this answer off the top of my head.
My girlfriend sold it.
Pie.
And sous vide that, man. Just go with it.
Sous vide that. I don't know. She likes eggs.
Yeah, you can sous vide eggs like a monster. My girlfriend sold it to herself. She was like, I was talking to her because she doesn't eat meat. And she was just like, can it cook vegetables? And I was like, oh, it can cook vegetables better than anything you've ever eaten. She's like, oh my gosh, that's so awesome. I know.
No, so my plan for this year, here's my plan. And so hopefully this will work out, is I'm going to take a cooking class this year. So
nice.
I'm going to learn how to cook. And I'm going to do a little more cooking. And then we're also going to get an induction cooktop, which is my, like, you know, to further aid in that, because our current one's garbage. And I probably could just get another electric one, but, you know, I don't know. There's something cool about induction. And then I was like, oh, it'd be cool if I'm, you know, if I progress that far to then somehow justify the sous vide. I don't know about the Wi-Fi, though. Why would you? It's 900 watts. I wonder. Whereas the other one is only 800 watts. I wonder how big of a deal that is. But
why would you want Wi-Fi, James? Why wouldn't you want Wi-Fi?
Because it's another $100 for Wi-Fi.
Yeah, and it's worth it.
Okay. The 900 watts might be worth it, but I don't know about the Wi-Fi.
Yeah, for me, that's the hard. Wi-Fi is tough. I don't understand why I would need that. I mean, I get it, kind of, but one of the nice advantages of the sous vide, because it's like you can start it when
you're away. It's a slow cooker, essentially.
Exactly. It's the whole point of it is that it, like, never has to turn off. So why, like, let's say the steak has to cook for at least 4 hours in order to get done. Where you're like, okay, well, maybe you'd think, well, I want it to be done at 7, so with Wi-Fi, I can start it at 3 and it'll be done by 7. But the whole advantage of it is you can start it at 8 in the morning. It will never get a hot above medium well, and it will be still fully cooked by the time you come home. It doesn't actually need to be to ever turn on or off. Well, not to mention the fact that I'm pretty sure you can, like, yeah, whatever. I don't understand the idea of Wi-Fi. Nobody has sufficiently explained to me the advantage of that over Bluetooth, where you can just preset it. But maybe there's an advantage I haven't thought about yet. And like you said, that 900 watts might be a big deal too. It might just be one of those things where they upgraded it and they just are like, people won't really understand why 900 is so much more important than 800, but they'll like Wi-Fi. So we'll just throw enough features into it until we can charge $100 more. it'll be great.
Yeah.
So yeah. Anyways.
So congratulations to Innova, I guess, for getting getting purchased for $250 million.
That's pretty good. So they're not the only ones we should be giving congratulations to this week. Do you wanna see you're up next?
Oh, it's mine. I'm like, who else? yeah, so the crunchies happened this last week.
Yeah,
and so we got some winners, we got some losers, but we won't talk about them. We'll focus mostly on the winners, and we'll try to pick ones that we actually care about. Let's see here. I don't care about that one. I don't care about that one. Hardware of the year. Want to take a guess? Did you open it? Ready? Don't open it.
I have. Well, dude, it's so hard for me to open up websites. I've been going based on text. So, greatest hardware of the year. It had to come out this year, right?
Or last year, but yeah.
Do they give it to like big companies like Google?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. The fact that you're not saying yes tells me that it's not a the Pixel or the.
Correct. Yeah, they're more like what you would call a startup.
Yeah,
but they play fast and loose with that term sometimes. So, like,
right,
they might give something to Instagram, right? And you're like,
right,
what's that? Where does that fall into? Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
It's. Oh, I was interested. I got sidetracked by a smart oven, which got like third place, I think. Spectacles.
Oh, Snapchat. Really? They gave. We're done with this whole.
By the way,
this whole article.
By the way, I don't want to put this out here.
I think they've invalidated themselves.
Don't worry. Well, it'll be okay. I saw someone, a normal person, wearing spectacles.
Yeah.
On Friday.
I saw it in the wild. I haven't even seen it in the wild.
Yeah. You look like a total goob wearing
them. Oh, yeah.
I personally think worse than Google Glass, in my opinion.
That's pretty bad.
That's my opinion. Like, they make people, like, in all of their marketing videos or photos or whatever. Yeah, they look awesome, I guess. If you're not a millennial model...
that's
a different story.
That's the classic problem with like fashion, right? Is it like you'll see a picture and you'll be like, I want to dress like this. So you'll go out and buy those clothes and you'll look ridiculous because you don't have 4% body fat. Like
that's this one. This just, product.
Jeez.
I know. I saw it and just went, oh my word. I now understand why they didn't want to give them out to geeks and tech bloggers because
you would. That's really funny. It's the classic it's the Abercrombie Fitch strategy. One of the reasons why they get so much and they're not ashamed of saying this. One of the reasons why they get so much praise for being a fashion focused brand is because they just don't make sizes for larger people. Like you just can't, like they don't make it. They only make clothes that will fit skinnier people and just sort of like, and they're like, you know what? On average, more attractive people will be wearing it and people will think it's more fashionable because you've got to be attractive to wear it. Like it's a good marketing. Like I've said, Snapchat they are a marketing company that is worth being bought on their ability to market stuff at this point because they're good at other stuff, but marketing, they're pretty freaking amazing.
Yeah. No, I understand that.
I can't believe they gave it to the TechCrunch.
All right. The next one is best technology.
Okay.
This is an exceptional recent technological achievement. And here's where I was kind of like, I don't know. So here are the people who did not win. Okay.
Okay.
Tesla Solar Roof, which I'm like, yeah, they haven't really started producing it yet. So I'm okay with that. Blue Origin, Facebook Solar Plane, and SpaceX Falcon 9 Landing.
SpaceX Falcon 9 Landing didn't win.
Did not win. Instead, it was a company or a a product called the CRISPR Cas9. So CRISPR is an acronym. It stands for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats. Not only does it have the potential to radically change the genetic code of all humanity, but could also fundamentally affect our healthcare, food system, farming, and even manufacturing and production industries.
That one's fair. I actually I agree with them on that one. That was I forgot that happened this year. That was a pretty big deal.
Yeah, so we got that. The best app. A recent standout app that has earned a place on your home screen. Care to guess on that one?
Trying to think if Snapchat came out with anything stupid.
Once I say it, you're going to go, oh, yeah, of course.
Say it.
Pokemon Go.
Yeah.
Which their measurement, maybe it's like shockingly successful or popular app as opposed to best app.
Yeah, yeah.
They're defining best as like a ton of people downloaded it.
Which, you know,
we weren't really expecting it.
I'm going to say, I guess I would say this. If you're, you know, award season's stupid, silly season. Like, how do you, you know, how is it that Star Wars isn't, and Finding Dory didn't get nominated for anything.
I literally watched part of that movie today. It's pretty good, for the record.
Well, it is, and it didn't get nominated for anything in the Oscars, even though it is the top grossing movie, only behind Rogue One. That didn't get nominated for anything either. And you just kind of like, well, what are we judging things? But I mean, like, I understand that commercial success, because otherwise you'd have to nominate, you know, the Fast and Furious movies. Like, commercial success isn't the only only measure of best.
There's nothing wrong with that.
I know, but there's like, to some degree, it feel like it should at least be a consideration. So I don't hate the idea.
Wow, a lot of people really like this movie. Maybe there is something to it.
Yeah, I don't hate the idea of using that as a measurement for best. It's just, like you said, I'm not sure.
Prisma was one of the apps that didn't win, but was up there. So that was cool. And then Weed Maps was another one. Shocker. Let's see. Do we know any of the founder of the years? Do you know Jeff Lawson from Twilio?
I know of Twilio. I don't know much about him.
So he won. They went public, apparently, last year. So
congratulations.
And, I'm going to make you upset again.
Jeez.
Best startup video. Best launch or explanatory video.
Okay.
Spectacles. Apparently Slack had one that was pretty good. I didn't think the video was amazing. It was all about their vending machines, which everyone was more intrigued with the vending machines than the glasses themselves.
Well, yeah, it's you know, I'll say this. If you're going to give spectacles an award, one that is based entirely around marketing is probably the one they deserve most.
There you go. That's the one they got.
Because, well, they got another one, James. Hot new startup. Oh, man. It's probably a company that's been around like 5 years.
We've talked about them a little bit because they got bought out this year by Uber. Does that help?
Oh, auto?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could see that. They've been able to.
They actually like publicly launched last year. How crazy is that?
Yeah.
Okay. The best startup. Just like, this is what we consider to be the best.
I'm curious to know what is considered the best.
Oh man! All right. So here's what didn't win. The runner-up was Stripe, which is like accepting online payments, Diddy, right, Giphy, and SpaceX. Those did not win.
Okay.
Oh, go ahead if you got it.
So, well, I have a bad feeling that they're somehow going to couldn't consider Snap as a startup still.
They would, I bet, but they did not win.
Good.
Slack.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous to call them a startup, but I guess. Well, yeah, like you said, fast and loose. If SpaceX is a startup, I guess.
See, yeah. And I like this. Aside from that odd full-page ad in the New York Times, Slack had a shining year.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. That was definitely a misstep.
Yeah, but anyways, there you go. Those are the Crunchy Awards. Those are our best of the best, apparently.
I'm upset by that.
You know, is what it is.
It is a pair of goofy-looking sunglasses with a camera in it. I don't understand.
The best part is he shared a video with me, one of the 360-degree videos. Oh, it looks horrible on your phone.
I believe it.
Because it's just a tiny little circle that's centered.
Right.
And you're like, what is this? I don't. Okay, cool.
And when would it not be a goofy, terrible like version of that? Like,
well, you know, the idea would be like for the video, if you watched it on Snapchat itself, then it filled the whole screen. Okay, all right, I can get behind that. But if you try to share something outside, like it's designed for Snapchat, because if you do any sharing outside of it, it looks like garbage.
Right. And that's
that's my home star.
I gotcha. I knew where it would come from. Jeez, that's just terrible. That's just it's such a whatever.
I was in a debate with someone earlier this week. It was on Wednesday, on whether or not to purchase Snap stock when they finally IPO, and I was kind of on like I don't. You know, obviously, given our conversation last week, I was like, I don't see the long-term benefit. And after I saw the spectacles on a normal person, I was like, and definitely no. That made it obvious.
I did hear this week.
You don't at it like I look at, I've seen the AirPods too, and I go, I want those. Right. It makes no financial sense. I want those. You know, yeah. I see the Anova precision cooker and I go, I want one. It's $200. It's a little expensive, but I still want one. Like, there's that pull. I looked at the spectacles and went, no. Hey, I was someone who wanted Google Glass, you know? And I was like, that doesn't look that bad. This, I'm just like, no. I have a little bit of a cognitive bias because of Evan Spiegel. But I don't know. Like, usually there's certain things where I'm like, oh, I hate the company, but that's kind of cool.
Right. And the Apple Watch, I think, it got a lot of heat early on from critics saying like, oh, it's ugly because it's not circular. It's not like, it doesn't look like a watch. Like it's just not, it wasn't getting a ton of love early on from a design perspective, but obviously of course, you know, sales have proven this out. But I think the general populace were just like, even if they didn't love the look, there weren't people that were like, oh, that's super ugly, for the general populace, which is who you're trying to sell to,
right?
When you're a publicly traded company, like,
it's, generally,
you know, you don't care about the super elite small, unless it's entirely an advertising branding thing, and you're just trying to increase the brand value by having, you know, which is why companies who engage in those in fashion stuff that look ridiculous, that, well, it's art. It's not really meant to. For people to wear, it's art that's meant to improve your brand and help you sell stuff lower down. You know, help you sell stuff in Macy's that costs less and is, you know, not as fashion forward.
Well, that's kind of weird. Like, you get the sense with the LG, which you've seen this with other ones too, that the Android Wear, right? Yeah, they're not expecting it to go gangbusters and be a bestseller. Like, it's a demonstration piece that you can buy.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know, man. Jeez. Crunchies, TechCrunch, you have embarrassed yourself. You have degraded the quality of your award season. I don't get it. Maybe I'm a fuddy-duddy. I don't know. Maybe I'm an old man. I'm not millennial enough, James.
Yeah, you're not hip enough.
Yeah, maybe that's the problem, or maybe the problem is that I just all the sign or whatever. You know what? I'm over it, man. We're out of time.
I love it. You just like, you can't even think.
I know.
You're just so upset about it.
That's
awesome. All right. Let's move on. Let's change it up. We got a couple more things.
Unfortunately, I'm like really pretty much out of time. I'm gonna just throw this out there really quickly. Watch Netflix. Netflix is moving into merchandise, and they're changing what their company is from delivering other people's content to creating their own content. The next step is merchandising their own content for more money.
Dude, that's
and
a Disney game plan.
That's exactly what they're doing. And the reason I'm throwing this out there is because it's now clear. It helps clarify where the company is going, what their motivations are, and what their goals are over the next decade. And in and of itself, it's not that interesting of a move, but as sort of indicative of where they're going. And that's why
we were talking about that. We're like, where are they going next? And that totally makes sense.
Yep.
It's when they open up a theme park, you're going to go, oh, okay, I get the...
Yep.
I get it now. I get it. My only thing it's just worth mentioning is if for some strange reason you missed all the news and you missed the halftime show from the Super Bowl, which, by the way, I called it, which I was getting nervous at the end there. Anyways, Lady Gaga's Super Bowl halftime show thing, at the very beginning, there's cool drones that are like LED lights behind. It's all powered and run, like they're Intel drones. Apparently they make drones too now. And it's like, a single person can run all of them. And, there's some cool, like I'll link to this video that shows kind of, the company, I don't remember who was it? TechCrunch. They did like a behind the scenes when, Disney was doing, when Intel was working with Disney on their drone stuff, and there's a cool video, and like, it's pretty awesome when you watch a few hundred of them take off all at once. And it's like, it kind of figures out the best pattern to take off so they all don't crash. And if they're doing like a show of 300 drones, they'll actually have 600 on standby, and it will somehow go through and be like, well, which ones are best equipped, most ready, best battery, whatever, we're going to use those. And then if one, for whatever reason, drops out, oh, no problem. We'll just fly up another one to keep the picture going.
That's pretty awesome.
And all they have on them is an LED light. That's the whole point. Right. It's a light show. But anyways, like her thing was like a super small snippet of some really cool things that Intel's doing with Disney. You should check out the link.
I will do that when I get back home.
Yeah.
I can't watch YouTube on the... I've not seen a single commercial or anything of the halftime show. I've heard about it all, but I haven't been able to watch anything because I can't. My LTE isn't fast enough to do YouTube videos, but it's the only way that I can access Google services. So
no problem, man. You only got to watch the first, I don't know, minute of it.
I can't.
I understand. Well, when you get back, you should do it.
Will do.
Well, speaking of you getting back, you should probably get back to whatever it is that you're doing. And so I want to say thank you to everybody else for joining us, and thank you for listening to episode 281. We really do appreciate it. Don't forget, you can check out all the show notes with all the links at forlibros.com. Again, 281. If you'd like to get the show notes sent directly to you, you can do that on the very same page. It's super easy, or forlibros.com/email. And then finally, this podcast is supported by listeners just like you. And if you're interested in contributing, we have four different levels and ways that you can do that. You can be a fanboy, a nerd, a junkie, or a maven. And each of them have their own different levels of rewards. It's pretty sweet. Again, you can check out everything at forlibros.com. And yeah, on that note, I am James Furlow, and my award-winning brother is Matthew Furlow, and so we will talk next time.
Thank you.